Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Writer's Block. I am your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey, and we are streaming live to the Countercurrents, DLive, and Odyssey channel. And today, we have for you two exquisite guests to discuss the indifferences, inborn, natural, or however else you may describe them, between the Chinese and the Western mind, well, the Oriental mind and the Western mind more broadly, but specifically because we are, well, best acquainted, we could say, with the Chinese mind. Let's go with that. Well, here with me, I have Hoppa Perspective, who is a content creator and a YouTuber. I believe you are a YouTuber, Hoppa.
I have a YouTube channel, yes.
Yeah. And with us is, of course, Dr. Ricardo Duquesne of the Council for Euro-Canadians and author of The Uniqueness of Western Civilizations, one of the seminal texts of the dissident right. Way back in 2011, it was written, and it is a masterful piece of work. I recommend all of you should read it, even if you still haven't, and if you've already read it again. And I had a lot of fun reading it in preparing for this stream. Dr. Duquesne, how are you today?
I'm doing good. It's great to be here with the Countercurrents crowd. And just to be sure, your name is Shelby?
It's Gilvey, right? It is calibrated.
We say J, right? Gilvey and Hoppa. Hoppa is fine if I just say Hoppa.
Yeah, that's fine. Hoppa is fine.
All right.
It is a little uncomfortable. What I understand, Hoppa is a mild racial slur, but
it that is. That's my name, so I just went with it. I expect people to call me that. I mean, it's Hoppa Perspective, you know.
Right. Okay. And of course, Hoppa Perspective is famous in the dissident right for providing the Hoppa Perspective on dissident right politics, being half Asian, half white. It does give one unique perspective. You know, it may not be the optimal disposition for right wing, maybe even white nationalist politics.
I wasn't even thinking that. The reason I came up with that name is because I wanted to be upfront about my racial background. I didn't want to just be, you know, a mystery meat and, you know, hiding behind an anonymous, pseudonym. So I just, I watched Thulean Perspective a lot, and I thought, oh, Hoppa Perspective, that could be funny.
Yeah, it's a way from which you can view the world. Mm. Well, we are today here gathered to talk about China. Now, I think we started planning this show about 2 weeks ago, and in the two intervening weeks, much has happened with China. We are now seeing basically the implosion of the Chinese, real estate and financial markets, while at the same time, the United Kingdom, United States, and Australia are beefing up their stance to oppose the rise of China and their dominance in naval presence in the Pacific Ocean. But it all started with the decision of the Chinese Communist Party, which controls the Chinese government, to crack down on what they called sissy men in Chinese media. Now, Hoppa Perspective, he has a unique perspective as someone who is a liminal being between both worlds on this event. Hoppa, would you please take it away?
So from my personal experience, I don't have an academic understanding of this, like Dr. Duquesne over here, Professor Duquesne, but from my personal experience, being an American person that has had a foot in the Asian American world, they don't cultivate masculinity. I don't even think they have a. It's kind of like they're just saying don't. They're just trying to tell their men not to be sissies, but they're not going to do anything to cultivate masculinity. It's not something that they don't cherish it as like a cultural value the way that Europeans do. It's hard for me to. I'm trying to, like, there's so many different ways you could describe masculinity. Like, one way would could be, you know, thinking independently, or like freedom is associated with masculinity, like being a cowboy out in the prairies or something. You have freedom, you know, these sort of things, these connotations, they don't appeal to East Asian people, or at least not Chinese people, you know, or Koreans, you know, the Sino people. And it's really something that has made me struggle to identify with Asian Americans. And I think from what I can see on this side of the pond in the United States, you know, it seems like as far as like racial psychology goes, the Asian Americans here in America really aren't too much different from the East Asians in the old world in Asia. So they're, you know, they're not going to the Chinese Communist Party. They can get rid of sissy men, but they're not going to cultivate masculinity. And for them to try to do that would be like making water run uphill. That's not what they're trying to do. They just don't want them to go too far in the other direction. So
I've heard an interesting interpretation that basically what the CCP is trying to do is not so much curb feminine behavior among the Chinese men as much as save face before the international public. That,
yes, you know,
which is a very typically East Asian thing to do, saving, not that, you know, we don't have the concept of face in Western Europe, but you could say that the social life of East Asians is dominated by this concept. Dr. Duchesne, you have written quite a lot on, well, everything that Hapa just touched on, masculinity, individualism, this concept of liberty as a masculine virtue, and how it's uniquely Western. Would you please elucidate?
Well, I think Hapa is correct, even though I haven't studied masculinity in contemporary China. I think that he's correct that the concept of masculinity in China, if you go back in history, is very different from the way it is in the West. People have this mistaken notion that once you have a patriarchal society, and we know that almost all societies, if not all of them, throughout history have been patriarchal. So they have this assumption that it means men dominated and therefore those are masculine societies. The other mistaken notion they have is that if the society happens to be super patriarchal, so in this case, they are making distinctions. Some people are aware that, for example, pastoral, nomadic, Muslim, Arabian culture was hyper-patriarchal. So there is this idea that if they are hyper-patriarchal, it follows that women were even more suppressed. And if you have societies that are weakly patriarchal, or let's say even matriarchal, it follows that the status of women was very high. But that's not the case necessarily. It is my view that in the case of Europe, the masculinity of men, because it was associated, as Hapa was sort of suggesting, with notions of freedom, notions of I will act in a way that doesn't violate my honor as a man that is not subservient to some despot. Masculinity has that character in the West, so it's very different. But this kind of masculinity elevated women as well. So you have that paradox that in the West, and many people always have a hard time understanding this, that if you go back to images of women among Indo-Europeans, they dress in a way that was not what you might think as very oppressive. You see them in short skirts all kinds of embellishments, and they were not necessarily at the very, very top of some sort of royal aristocracy, but just the aristocracy in general. So I think this is important to take into consideration, and I think Hapa is sort of correct. You're not going to see in China some kind of cowboy masculinity. The American cowboy experience in many ways is a resuscitation of a masculinity that had been in decline in Europe. So when Europeans moved into the west of the United States, that resurfaced again. Likewise, in Australia, that's why to this day, some people say that Australians are more masculine men. And the reason for that is because of that open space, that sense that you can roam through the lands.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Yes,
whereas in England, France, I mean, you go back to the declining aristocracy, they were courtiers, very effeminate. So you know, this is something worth keeping into consideration.
So it's as if there's also like a, this gets into the rural versus urban divide. And I feel that East Asians are genetically a more urbanized race, to put it bluntly.
Yes. Again, that's a, it's difficult for me, it would be difficult to split it that way, because as you know, China was the quintessential peasant society with millions and millions of people working the land through millennia. And at the same time, they did have a high level of urbanization early on in their history. And Marco Polo, in his travels, was really impressed at the size of the cities and the high degree of urbanization. But on the other hand, then Chinese urbanization barely increased through the modern era, whereas European urbanization just kept on increasing and increasing at a very fast rate. So even though in the 1800s or 1700s, the big European cities were still not at the same size in terms of population as the Chinese cities, Europe as a whole had undergone a rapid rate of urbanization. So I don't know if I would say that it is a rural-urban divide and the rural cultivates this masculinity. I think the masculinity is connected to what I see as the aristocratic spirit of the West. You can't be an aristocrat and lack that masculinity. I mean, the obsession in the Iliad of not being dishonored, of maintaining the behavior that it corresponds to a man of is an aristocrat and is independent. So you have Achilles really challenging Agamemnon, and he is the king. But Achilles, right from the very opening of the Iliad, takes him on, and Homer portrays him as more of a man than even Agamemnon. Although, I mean, Agamemnon is a man, but he's not the central character. So I think it's very interesting. I mean, I have studied the degrees of masculinity across cultures, not in a very in-depth way, but I think you can make distinctions. The Indians too, the people of India, they may well be even less masculine than the Chinese, although not initially, because the Indians were influenced a lot by the Aryan invasion. But through time, they were swallowed up by that big piece of land with so
many trees. We are, modern Indians are not described in the Bhagavad Gita or the Indian epic poem. I forget its name right now. That is, I believe what Hapa was alluding to with the urbanization comment is that whereas China has historically always been a peasant society, the Chinese elite has always been an urban elite. Whereas for a very long time, the Western elite was, rural. We were not courtiers.
I was going to get into that.
We were counts and dukes and barons and had our own courts. And here I use the term court in its full meaning, because a local feudal lord was expected to pass judgment in his domain. And the king was the ultimate judge, but he was also a judge. He was first among equals to a far greater degree than an emperor surrounded by a court of eunuchs, of subservient eunuchs. And of course, the court eunuch is a staple of Chinese and Arab imperial rule, whereas we do not see as much of court eunuchs figuring in Western history. Mm-hmm. I am, our illustrious moderator Bartleby reminds me that the Indian epic's name is the Mahabharata. It's not something written about modern Indians. I will remind everyone watching that this show is part of the Countercurrents umbrella, so you can donate to Countercurrents on Entropy. You can post questions to me, you can post questions to Hapa, and you can post questions to Dr. Ricardo Duchesne, and all three of us. At any point, I have access to the Entropy account of Countercurrents, and I will read all donations and questions sent for the durations of this show. So, you know, Countercurrents is having a fundraiser. I couldn't believe that being a dissident rightist costs so much money, but it does. It does. A lot of resources go into this show, a lot of preparation. So we would be grateful for your support. And Alaska Chaga has broken the ice on dlive.com by donating an ice cream, which is equivalent to 10 lemons. Hats off to Alaska Chaga, and I would love to sample your product someday. You should begin shipping to Europe any day now, Alaska Chaga. So I'm sorry to have interrupted you. Hapa, do you have anything to add to that?
From my understanding, I think that there is some nuance in that. There is like a divide in Europe too between the Western hunter-gatherer populations in the north and the Neolithic farmer populations more around the Mediterranean, and should maybe factor in at least a little bit when you compare Europe to East Asia, because when you compare, like, let's say the Chinese to Europeans, they have more in common with like the Neolithic farmer peoples in Europe around the Mediterranean, because they both sort of started out as like farming civilizations. So when I speak of them being more urbanized, I guess in my mind, I'm not just thinking like big cities, but they had like, you know, large farming communities in a single territory that they defended. Whereas Indo-Europeans, you know, they were pastoralists, and the Western hunter-gatherers were, you know, hunting and gathering, and they existed in a more rural, they had a more rural lifestyle for a much longer time. And if they did have settled villages, they were smaller until a certain point in history where they started settling down more. But in my mind, you know, the Chinese, that's to me what makes them like psychologically more urbanized people.
Yeah, another characteristic that highlights the nature of Chinese masculinity is that, as I recall, they were conquered quite a few times, and they generally bought off a lot of the more aggressive masculine nomads to the north. Even the last Qin empire was founded by these nomadic peoples to the north, who were more masculine than the Chinese themselves. Yes.
Manchu, right? The last Chinese dynasty is Manchu.
Yes, Manchu. So that's another thing that I noticed about China. But again, you cannot make generalizations, and I'm not an expert. And I know that China had the long period of the wars where they were continuously fighting against each other. And so I would imagine that, yes, you have this kind of aggressive masculinity being nurtured in that climate. But on the other hand, they were known to be a relatively peaceful civilization within and to maintain that kind of order. Yes, but you know, there are many aspects to this. You can go back also to Confucianism, a very different text from anything that you see in the Western world.
Right. It is possible, however, if we're talking about effects on the population of modern China, because we know from the research of Dr. Michael Woodley of Maine and others that prolonged warfare has pronounced dysgenic effects on the population. And it is very possible that the Opium Wars and the Boxer Rebellion and then the warlords periods of China, culminating in the Japanese invasion and the Chinese Civil War, and then topped off by Mao's great leap forward and cultural revolution, that these were all just one dysgenic bottleneck, one after the other, until every last masculine Chinese man was either killed or expelled from the country, maybe ran away to Taiwan or somewhere else. And so we may be dealing with modern China, with a civilization which is always had this predilection towards the feminine and towards a less inspired mind maybe than West, but now they're also coming out on the other end of this gauntlet of dysgenic pressures, which has been constant internecine warfare and then genocidal communism for 100 years, and only now maybe the beginnings of a repairing of the genetic stock repairing itself can begin, but it will remain to see. Maybe that's.
I don't think biology can help. Getting rid of the sissy men isn't going to cut it. They have to go much further than that. Mm. I don't think they want that. I don't think they want it. Masculinity is not something that they value.
No, from my understanding,
and they can
of Chinese,
be successful. I mean, it's not as if China needs to go crazy about masculinity to be successful. They so far have been very successful, and compared to the West, they have a far stronger sense of national identity, cohesion, and attachment to their culture and history, and that will carry you far, those attitudes. So I don't know that they would say that we lack masculinity. Their armies, I'm sure, are very well trained and are very good and cohesive and would function very well. I mean, they're just laughing at the Americans at what happened to them. You see, the Taliban, on the other hand, you could argue these are a masculine.
Yes.
But on the other hand, I mean, it's a backward society.
You wanted to say something, Harper?
What was I going to say? I was going to let you speak. I had a passing thought. I think you're right. I just feel like that's the cost of their cultural practices has led them to become they're like spiritual. Their men are like spiritually eunuchs or something. They might have a strong army, but it's an army of like spiritually they're like eunuchs. I don't know, that's the best description I can come up with now. And but my understanding of East Asian people mainly comes from my experience. I've never been to China, but my experience here in America, in the United States, with Asian Americans that have been like born here and English is their first language. And it's like, I see this with them. I see this kind of like this lack of masculine spirit, if you will. And it just makes me think that this is definitely a racial psychological issue. You know, they're not keen on living outside of cities or in the American context. I mean, something that I find to be perplexing that I often talk about is they're the least likely to own firearms. And that's bizarre to me, because in terms of like just self-defense, they're like the smallest people, you know, and there's just something about the way they think that they gravitate away from certain things and towards other things, you know.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Also, I guess when you were referring to the rural, you may also have in mind this peculiar characteristic about Europeans, which is that they don't mind going to the countryside. It's not so much that they are rural in the old peasant concept of it, But I live in New Brunswick, and I see that many people much prefer to be in the countryside. When you go to the countryside, the men are more masculine.
Correct.
They like guns. You even to this day will see the flag. I just, you know that famous American flag. You'll see it at the Southern flag.
The Confederate flag.
Right, the Confederate flag. You'll see it in homes. I think you're right. And the other thing that I noticed too is that when you said that they much prefer to live in the city, I think this is true of Middle Eastern people, Indian people, African people. They just love big, noisy cities, cars, and that stuff. Whereas there is a reasonable proportion of whites that will withdraw and don't mind withdrawing from society, even going all alone into the wild. It's a very peculiar characteristic. Now, whether that's just masculinity per se, I wouldn't say that. There's another, something else is going on there.
There's more to it, yeah.
Right, there is individualism, there is the love of adventure, being alone, meditating, doing your own thing. Yes, you do see, notice this. That's why whites generally love to go on, walks in the woods.
Right.
Here it's quite common. I mean, they go right into the wild and go there for days. That is interesting because
there have been, and I laugh at these things, but complaints from the woke left that camping is too white. Basically, whites are the only race in America and elsewhere that ever really go camping. And the Z-Man has commented on this, and he grew up in the South in a mixed neighborhood, so he knows black people quite well, that black people are just afraid of the woods for some deep, probably primordial reason. And if we are speculating, I would speculate it's because the European forest is nowhere near as dangerous as the jungle, or in the case of Middle Eastern people, the desert. Because I've been to the desert when I was in Egypt, and it's a very nice place. It's a hauntingly beautiful place, but you can tell at sight that you don't want to be there, especially not alone. Whereas a European forest, it has dangers, and as someone who has been chased by a wild boar while completely unarmed, I can attest that the European forest can be very dangerous. It is not as intent on killing you as the desert or the jungle. So maybe that's at the root of it, but I'm just speculating at this point. And we have donations coming in. We have to account for these donations. We have a diamond on DLive from Old Man Yinzer. Well, thank you for that, Old Man Yinzer. And three ice creams from Norse Nature. Let me just snap over to Entropy to see if there have been any donations in these 30 minutes that we've been having this show. Well, not that I can see, but you know, the night is still young. We have mentioned the spiritual difference between Asians and Europeans. And in my reading of your work, Dr. Duchesne, I've really been amazed at the insights you have made as to the transcendental mind of Europeans, which, as you have so eloquently written, stands above the embedded mind of Asians. Now, if you would, in the briefest possible terms, explain this, while our erstwhile moderators post the link to this article in the chat, if you will.
Yes, the article, like there is an early version in Countercurrents, but then I developed that whole argument and formally published it. And you can find it at ResearchGate. So embedded means that you are tied to social relationships, your status in society, you are tied to nature to a higher degree, because, and I know this sounds crazy to people who are into genetics, but I think that non-whites are more biologically determined than whites. This is just a very subtle difference. Clearly, white people are biological beings, but in my view, they transcend to higher degree the world of biological determinations. So the notion of transcendental, it has many meanings. If you go to the United States, it's associated with a very American movement of the late 19th century, and it just meant coming up with moral values that transcend your own self-interest, your own person, your own culture, and are about humanity, about creating harmony among all the peoples of the world. And that's an aspect of transcendentalism, and you can see it there, because when you look at the history of ethics of European peoples, it is a transcendental ethics in a way that is not the case elsewhere. Although we have to be careful, because Confucianism has an element of transcendentalism, and so does the Axial Age thinking of Persia and India. So you can see the inklings of a transcendental mind. It didn't go further, or it didn't get beyond what the Axial Age achieved, whereas in Europe it did. There are many ways to approach this. Another way, which is sort of what I was already saying, is that kinship relationships in the West were weaker very early on, mm-hmm. and then eventually they were really broken down. And so we have these smaller nuclear families, and Europeans went on to form groups and associations that are based on values that are not rooted in family, extended family values and obligations, but are simply values that you come up with, and you say, we are going to live according to this set of rules, and so on. And that's an element of transcendentalism, because to be transcendental, you cannot belong to a closely knit kinship group. You have to rise above that, because kinship groups will shape your mind, will regulate your behavior. I mean, when you marry, who you marry, how you treat your elders, how do you relate to strangers, what kind of costumes and norms you follow were all set by the kinship group. Whereas if you have weaker kinship relationships, then your mind will rise above that and then will start taking off and start coming up with values on the basis of its own reasoning. So you see the pre-Socratics doing this, and then the Plato and other philosophers begin to try and come up with values that are based on their own thinking, not the conventions of the time. And so by the time you get to Kant, I mean, you have outright a transcendental metaphysics. The transcendental unity of a perception, I mean, big terms like that. So I think that this is an important contrast that we should pay attention to. And that is also connected to the fact that Europeans came up with all kinds of philosophies and music, even classical music. I mean, it's hard. While classical music is 100% European, at the same time, you can't say it's a folksy music that, you know, is really rooted in a particular land and community. It was really cosmopolitan. So it has that kind of transcending quality.
Although it is an elite phenomenon, in the cases where classical music incorporates a specific time and a place and a people, it does so as a way of sampling. It's when Antonin Dvorak incorporates the polka into his symphonies, he really does that as an explorer or a conquering, observing his own people, ironically, and integrating a piece of their culture into the overarching elite or cosmopolitan culture, right, which is represented by classical music. Now, it's not that classical music does not contain folk elements, but it treats them like something to be taken or observed or discovered and integrated into an already existing form and structure which spans the entirety of European culture.
Yes, it is rooted and at the same time cosmopolitan. And Wagner may have been alluding to that when he said that German classical composers, there is something deeper in the music than the Jewish composers, because the Jewish composers are eclectic. They just borrow pieces and pieces from various places, and they don't have that strong sense of peoplehood and attachment when they take this music that they borrow from various places in Europe. So it's not an easy argument to articulate. It takes time, and you have to go slowly through it. But my point being that classical music has a transcendental quality, which again explains the Chinese themselves, particularly here in the West, have become very good musicians of classical music. They can relate to it in a way that, of course, they would not relate to purely Polish or Italian folk songs and compositions. And they wouldn't relate to it in that way. So transcendentalism is a very heavy going discussion, but I'll leave it at that for now. Yeah.
What I think is interesting is that East Asians are, you know, especially when they're here in the West, but even in the East, they're so eager to assimilate to Western values, even within Asian society. So that speaks to the transcendentalism of Western culture and Western music and arts. And I was reading your article on Countercurrents, and you mentioned this while you were talking earlier. I didn't want to interject, but you were talking about how the Chinese sense of self is embedded within the collective. And something I wanted to point out from my own personal experience here in the in a Western context with Asian American people, you know, that speak English as a first language, is that they are still a very they suffer from social, I think, status anxiety rather more. They suffer from status anxiety more than any other group that I've observed, and they're very status conscious people, and a lot of their pursuits are directly or indirectly tied to status, like their pursuit of education.
Yes, and they seem to have a far weaker sense of self.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. The Western sense of self, of course, has a long history, and you cannot in any way today, the sense of self is very different right now from what it was 50 years ago. And it has radically changed, and we tend to look at it negatively, because when you see a white person with full of tattoos and rings and somehow trying to remake himself and so on, it seems kind of thick, and there's a sickness there. And I do think that it has reached a point where it has become a sickness, because they have no other reference that is bigger than themselves. Very weak attachments to their families, to their extended.
You're talking about family. The dark side of individualism.
Yes, as it has manifested itself now in the West. And so when you talk about it, people kind of have this ambivalence about it. And they say, why are you praising?
Bad connotations.
Yes, but...
Well, it's very on brand for our civilization, I would say. Every time the Western self reinvented itself, it did so by negating the old self. We had a pagan civilization which reinvented itself as a Christian civilization by repudiating its paganism. And of course, then we had a Catholic and Orthodox civilization which developed into the modern civilization. Now we have a post-Christian civilization which functions by negating our Christian past and our Western past. We are in a process of almost complete post-Christianization, and we are somewhere midway in the in the middle between being a Western and a post-Western society. So, and every time, and I know this from because I've undergone personal growth, you cannot really achieve personal growth and develop a new self without repudiating and even ritualistically destroying the old self, which in my case, what I did was at one point, I just took away all the junk in my house, which reminded me of all, you know, the leftist I used to be, and threw it out. In the case of Western civilization, it might just be tearing down these statues of great Western and Christian men. And even, you know, they set fire to the statue of the elk in Portland, which is baffling to me. Why would you want to set fire to the statue of an elk? But this becoming of the West, this reinvention of the self, it's what we do periodically in our civilization. Whereas the Chinese, they will claim to be the oldest civilization, not because they were first, but I think they have a continuity of civilization, even as all these foreigners pour into China, even as Mongols and Jurchens and Manchus and all sorts of foreigners pour into China, and finally the Japanese and the Marxists. Let's not forget, you can think of the CCP as a form of Marxist barbarians who are now ruling China, but China just absorbs all of them and fuses them into this unchanging or very slowly changing continuity, which it is. Maybe that's a deep civilizational differences, that the West has a sense of self, but the Chinese, they don't have a sense of self because I don't think they feel it in time, just because it has been there for so long.
Yes. They're the eternal Borg.
Yeah.
We can, I think that this is a very long and deep subject which we can discuss for a very long time, that I think, as Hoppe put it, a spiritual otherness to the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you speak to someone who is Chinese, and maybe even Oriental in general, I've seen Koreans who are like this too, the lack of a sense of self, and I don't think they see themselves as individuals. And of course, individualism is a problem of the West. In its degenerate form, it will probably kill us. But the minimum individualism we need to forge a civilization of the type of the West, even that is lacking in East Asia. I think that an East Asian person at all times sees themselves as a promontory of their entire, maybe not tribe, but something or other. They do not see themselves as a independent unit of action. And I've been trying to get this, to get my friends and allies to accept this, that an individual is very rarely historically an independent unit of action and an ecologically viable form of human life. The only ecologically viable form of human life that we know is the community. But this is just, it's a paradox. I think that the Chinese are strong in that particular area, which is our greatest weakness. But they are very weak in the area which is our greatest strength, the will to conquer, to explore, to understand, to subjugate, and ultimately to set to seek freedom.
They have no problem subjugating their own.
I don't think they're wrong. It's you see historically the Han subjugate other peoples, even such peoples which have invaded and conquered China, just mm-hmm. absorb them.
Yeah.
I mentioned that the last emperor of China was a Manchu, an ethnic Manchu from Manchuria. The Manchu are almost extinct today. There are very few of them left alive speaking their own language in Manchuria. They have been absorbed into the Han. This will likely be the fate of the Tibetans and the Uyghurs. So who really won? Who really conquered
right.
whom?
That's an interesting way of looking at it, and you're right.
But I have one question for Hapa, right? So when you look at Chinese that are born in the United States and have been thoroughly socialized as much as you can in a Western culture, don't you see that they become more individualistic, have a stronger sense of self, or do you think this is so deeply rooted?
I wanted to touch on this. Yes. I'm sorry. Did you want to finish the question? I was just.
I mean, it could be ontogenetic. It doesn't have to be genetic. Ontogenetic means you can even transfer it from family to family because it's just hard to change it.
I think it's genetic because I've even had this experience with other Hapas. I see myself as an extreme outlier that's more inclined towards his white racial psychology. Maybe I got more of those genes in my brain. I don't know. I'm half Anglo-Saxon and half Chinese, and the Anglo-Saxons are like the most individualistic and the Chinese are the most collectivist. So I don't know. I feel like I got lucky there. But my experience even with other Hapas has been that Asian Americans and Hapas being anyone that's at least half East Asian, meaning like Japanese, Korean, Chinese, that on a superficial level, they internalize Western values and culture and Western culture. Like they understand and buy into these concepts of individualism, but it just, there's just a wall somewhere. I'm trying to think of how to articulate this.
I think like, what you mean, Hapa, is that they treat Western culture as a test to be passed.
Yes. It's like, for example, the Asian American woman being status conscious and suffering from status anxiety. And, you know, Asian people are more interested in social climbing than being individuals. She'll try to become like a white woman. She'll go to Starbucks. She'll, you know, only date white guys that are over 6'5". I mean, it's like, you know, because she wants to, and she'll support Black Lives Matter because those are, you know, white girl. That's what she perceives as like the white Western girl thing to do. She'll even dye her hair blonde or something. And she's like, oh, I mean, you know, she thinks she's an individual and she thinks she believes in democracy and freedom. But it's almost like they're just wearing like some sort of like skin suit or something. It's not like they can't actually, they don't want to go out into the woods and do their own thing. And go, they rarely want to go against the grain. Now, of course, there's always exceptions. I believe I'm one of them, you know. But most of them, it's just the worst sort of, they're very sensitive to peer pressure. Like if you look at for example, the whole Asian hate crime narrative, we all know that Asian Americans, or let's just say in general, including Canada, Asians in North America are being victimized by blacks. Like the majority of people attacking East Asians are, like I would bet money 98% of the perpetrators are black. But because of the establishment's narrative, the mainstream narrative being that only white people can be racist and violent oppressors, they're going with that narrative because they're assimilating, right? They're just buying into the authoritative perspective, which is that white people are the villains of history and responsible for all racism, and you know, the one white guy that does something to an Asian person that makes news, and not the hundreds or thousands of black on Asian attacks. I made a video about this, and it's just something that I see it over and over again. And I know personally that Asian Americans, if they're being honest, some of them will admit that blacks are the problem in their communities. But even as they're aware of it, there's this need, this extremely powerful impulse within them to conform to whatever the establishment is telling them, and they want to win brownie points with the establishment. So it's also pragmatic from their perspective because they want to keep their minority victim status, you know, going. So they want to win.
That's my sense as well, that the differences are far deeper than people realize, mm-hmm. because the Western world has bet everything on the expectation that immigrants, even if they're different, the first generation, so they say, oh, Muslims, you know, the first generation, the Indians, they'll be different, but give them time. Look at the Italians, look at the Portuguese, they all assimilated to Anglo culture. And I'm of the view that again, there seems to be something sensible about that remark. I mean, you kind of say, okay, yeah, I mean, if the children are going to go to Western schools, they read Western stories, watch Western movies, and they must give up some of the older Chinese ways if you just give it time. But then another side of me says, well, no, the differences are deeper because they go back for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Thousands.
Like right now, to me, the difference between the West and the rest is a deep psychological difference. Most academics have reduced the West to when did the West industrialize? Why did it industrialize first? Or, you know, some go further back and realize, well, you got to address modern science. So why did the West acquire this modern scientific mind, and they leave it at that, and they don't realize that it really, you know, modern science, yes, it sprang in the 16th century, took off, but it has roots in the medieval and the ancient world, and then there are many other aspects about the West that go beyond science, go beyond the Industrial Revolution, and relate to all kinds of aspects of human.
It's very interesting when we're discussing, we are always hammered with this data point that the Arabs preserved the writings of Aristotle and Cicero and other ancient wise men, but they did nothing with these writings all the time they had them. Whereas the minute white men reacquired this knowledge, we immediately put it into practice and developed the Renaissance. And of course, This is what's striking about the uniqueness of the West, even if we are set back by disasters such as the Dark Age or the Islamic conquests. The second we get our chance back, there is no hole stopping us.
You kind of see that today. Sorry to interrupt. Like what you're talking about with Muslims and Aristotle or you know classical Greek philosophy. It's kind of like East Asians are preserving classical music, even as it's falling out of favor in the West. Mm-hmm. So sorry, go ahead.
Yes, maybe in the future we can pick up where we left off once we have shaken off this civilization-killing disease, which has taken us right now. And we will have the East Asians to thank for that, as we had the Arabs to thank for the preservation of Aristotle and Plato. But I don't think they're going to do much with classical music. Much has been said about, you know, Asians playing classical music, but I think they're mostly doing that to ingratiate themselves in, because classical music is still, to a great degree, a provenance of the elite. There's a lot of complaints about this. Why should we publicly fund conservatories and operas and ballets when it's just rich people going to the ballet and the opera? And all of these things. Well, why should we take, you know, tax the poor to finance rich people's hobbies? But this is high culture. This is civilizational art, which you know, should be preserved. And I think that the inertia, the status inertia of classical music is still strong enough that Asians will probably learn how to play classical instruments and deal in classical music. For a very long time, longer than white people, possibly.
And they'll keep a carbon copy of it.
What I really see is when you look at international relations, you look at China, you look at the Chinese state, and they're not, because this is still a white man's world. It's still the West, which is the dominant civilization, even though we are very rapidly weakening. they're still trying to impress us in international relations. Hence, they're trying to save face with this sissy thing. Hence, they are forcing themselves into a space program, even though they don't really care about space. The Chinese do not care about the moon. They do not care about the outer orbit. There is no Chinese astronomy the way there is Western astronomy. There is no Chinese even naval tradition. The Chinese do not have a naval tradition. They're doing this to counter the West and maybe show us that they too can do it. The Belt and Road Initiative, again, they are not natural explorers or even long-range merchants. They're doing this because the entire nation of China is trying to show us that, well, everything we can do, they can do better. But they wouldn't think of doing something, because the Europeans, back when, you know, we were the quote-unquote backwater, we did not, we were not obsessed with showing China that we're better than them. No, we did our own thing. We explored the world because it was its own reward. Yes, it was done to seek out new markets and new lands to colonize. But at some point, this is just too great a risk. And you stick to what you know is profitable. You know, trade silk, trade spices, buy salt from the blacks in Africa, buy steel from Damascus or Spain. You have to be a little crazy or a little Western to set out on a ship to blue nowheres and stick a roundabout route to India like Christopher Columbus did. It's when we were the weaker civilization, if we were at the time the weaker civilization, we did not have this combination of resentment and hero worship which the Chinese have for us today. And that's what's very interesting to me. This is probably what you're getting at, what both of you are getting at, that there we live in the heads of the Chinese. They see us, they want to be us. For a time, I don't know if it's still true, you can make very good money in China as a professional white man. Just go there and they give you money for being white.
But I would say that the Chinese now are beginning to think of themselves as having a superior culture. I wouldn't say that they have that state of inferiority and dependence which they exhibited from the late 19th century until about the 1970s, 80s. I think they're pretty perplexed as to how it is that Americans have turned against themselves, are desecrating their own history, are in awe of blacks. I mean, blacks in commercials now, it's just amazing. Even Fox News, it's just blacks and blacks, and I mean, on and on. So if a Chinese person is watching this, they are like, these people, there must be something wrong with them at this point. And so, and the same goes for Britain and France. I mean, they're all incredibly wimpy leaders. I mean, Macron embracing Negroes. It's just a phenomenon that has no parallels in human history. So I think the Chinese are have gained a lot of confidence, and they to them the West is in a terminal kind of path, and Russia, the one that stands out, their economy is not as dynamic as the Chinese economy. People are not in the world buying Russian products, and so they themselves are demographically colonizing some eastern parts of Russia as well. You know, I mean, the geopolitics will always remain, the geopolitical struggles. It's not as if the Chinese are going to be dominating everyone. But I would say the Chinese at this point are quite confident of themselves. I notice it more and more when you see them walking around Vancouver and that. They walk with confidence. They feel they dominate the universities. If you walk into a science department, it's majority Chinese or Asian, East Asian. So they have to notice that we are beating them. And now the Indians are coming, and they're coming in loads. And the Indians can be good, and, you know, not the lower IQ ones necessarily come, let's say, to Canada at least. So some of the more on average higher IQ Indians are coming, and they can be quite dominant. And they too are looking at whites, and this is just trash. And then a people that negates itself can never be respected. It's just the law of nature. You cannot have a Biden as a president, and people can respect that. They did respect Trump. So I'm worried. I mean, I think something is happening. I think the chances that the white race will commit suicide are high. And the window to get out of this, the window of opportunity is getting smaller and smaller. And the next generation of white people is already born, is already around, is even weaker. So imagine that. They don't have any families. They don't connect. If you don't have a family, which the Chinese still do, and the Muslims do, and the Indians do, if you don't have a family, you're done. You're dead. White women can cook. Chinese women can cook, and Indian women can cook, and Muslim women, on average. White women can. They can do anything. Just look at what they're buying in supermarkets. Crackers, a Lipton soup, you know, it's just ridiculous. Nachos and salsa, you know. I say this because my wife is a very good cook, and she can cook anything. And she comes from that traditional Greek background where that was instilled on her.
I want to take a second to thank Mrs. Jillian for being a beautiful, wonderful cook and a good wife who does not buy nachos. just makes you realize what you have.
Yeah.
That is.
So, yeah, that's just a point, an observation.
Right. We have donations, so I'm going to have to read them, I guess. We have donations on DLive from Gadius Maximus, a diamond. Thank you for that, sir. And we have 5 ice cream from Norse Nature and 2 lemons from Donning Armor. Thanks to all of you. Your help is greatly appreciated. And now I am turning to Entropy, where donations come in real money, believe it or not. So we have 3 new donations. We have a question for Hapa Perspective from Gadius Maximus for $10. Hapa has been going hard for the Second Amendment on his Telegram lately. What got him so interested in it, and why is it so important to him? Hapa.
There's a bunch of reasons. Some of them are personal. Let's just say, given my racial background, but really on both sides, I come from culturally more urbanized people, and, you know, there was the whole thing with like, ooh, no guns in the home, and, you know, everything is dangerous, and I don't feel like growing up, I didn't have like a masculine upbringing. I didn't get to like go out into the woods much or learn to hunt or anything, and I grew up in this like commuter town, this kind of suburban culture where people watch the news and they're afraid of everything. And, you know, boys are dissuaded from being masculine. Everything's dangerous. And so I part of it on a personal level is kind of like, rectify that, or, you know, redeem that myself in that area. So part of it is embracing masculinity, you know, freedom, liberty, and, you know, to me, yeah, I think it's part of being a man, part of not just being an American. I mean, the Second Amendment comes from England. It comes from Europe. You know, that we kept that English tradition alive. It came from the English Bill of Rights. But in a collectivist sense, I mean, you know, tyranny is a problem, and as much as we want order in our societies, in our countries, I mean, it's like, if you get the wrong order, you need to be able to fix that. And that's kind of the point of the Second Amendment and the political crisis that all of us are facing. And I don't feel bad talking about it. It's in our Constitution. I should be able to talk about it in, like, at least in academic sense. You know, I'm not advocating for anything, but it's right there in our Constitution. It doesn't say we have this thing for defense against thugs so they don't steal our TVs or something. You know, it's more than that. And I think it's part of, like, a deeper, like, it's the spiritual successor of a very long and old Indo-European tradition of you know, and culture of being martial.
Yeah, universal male martiality, or yes, as close as you can get to universal. Mm-hmm. I don't think all men are cut out to be warriors, but sure, all men should familiarize themselves with weapon.
But I believe in meritocracy, like, yeah, individual Indo-European meritocracy. If this is something that you feel that is right for you, you should be able to do this. And, you know, like, I was rejected by the military for, like, trivial medical reasons. Oh, you're allergic to peanuts, so you can't join the warrior class now. Screw you. You know, this is the kind of world, clown world, that we live in. So
are the Taliban shooting peanuts now?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. So, you know, that's also an issue for me. And it's like a spiritual thing for me. Like, okay, well, they rejected me, but I have this. So sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to put that in there.
No problem. I think that Dr. Duquesne, would you agree that, I wouldn't say universal, but pretty widespread martiality and, that all European peoples and that European civilization as a whole has a strong martial aspect, which we do not observe in the rest of the world?
We observe it in some civilizations more so than in others, and the West is one of them where you see it to a very high degree. So, for example, among the Aztecs in the Mesoamerican world, they were known to exhibit a higher level of martiality and masculinity, whereas the Mayas to a lesser degree. So these distinctions are important. People don't like to make those distinctions anymore. The same, as you know, with most peoples from the Eurasian steppes, the Huns, the Mongols, and many other groups, have exhibited a high degree of martiality, a warrior ethos. The Indo-Europeans happen to be the first coming out of the steppes, and they spread out. And they spread out together with their domestication and riding of horses, invention of vehicles, their pastoralism, their diet of dairy products. So that made them very strong, and that's part of also their martiality. So I would say, yes, that Europeans have shown that throughout history. I mean, in the period from 1500 to 1800, Europeans were at war 2 years of every 3 years, continuously. When you read a history book of Europe, it's ongoing, persistent, permanent war, and bickering with each other. The same thing with the Greeks. The ancient Greek city-states were constantly fighting with each other. The same thing with the Romans. And then they created, in many ways, the most bellicose empire in human history. The Romans, too, when they were rising to become the dominant power in Italy, this is, if you take the 3rd century BC, they're at war continuously. And warfare was everything in Roman culture. So yes, it is a phenomenon that today, when you look at Europeans today, they will strike you as the most peaceful people in the world, incredibly emasculated. And yet these people used to be the most bellicose, aggressive people in the world. Which, you know, another point that contrasting Europeans to the Chinese, when you look at Chinese imperialism, it was essentially driven by demographic pressures. it was not as if a conqueror decided to go and take over all the lands. It was more that slowly, imperceptibly, there will be a peoples moving to other areas, and more of them would move, and eventually the Chinese government would come in and declare that area to be Chinese and then impose itself. They're doing the same thing today, to this day. They did it in Taiwan. Taiwan was not Chinese. Mongolia was not Chinese. Mongolia is a very big piece of land. It was just demographic colonization. They wanted to do it in Canada. Mongolia. Yeah, so inner Chinese Mongolia. Imperialism is demographic. Whereas in European imperialism, you have Hernando Cortes, Pizarro, Francis Drake, and so on. So you have all these characters, and that is a dramatic contrast.
Yeah, that is very interesting, because in Cortes' conquest of Mexico, we are seeing the clash of two extremely warlike civilizations, the Western civilization and the Aztec Nahuatl civilization. And I personally consider that a fascinating part of history. I mean, just think of the drive and the boundless ambition that a man like, and of course, boundless self-confidence and discipline a man like Hernán Cortés would need. I have often quoted his decision to burn the ships behind him as one of, it just a stroke of strategic genius. The only way out is forward. Mm-hmm. And then you know that the men will fight like lions against unbelievable odds. And yet for all of his martiality, when you really look at the conquest of Mexico, it was first and foremost a diplomatic triumph, that Hernán Cortés could very accurately read and perceive the internecine conflicts of the various Nahuatl tribes and the various tribes which opposed the Aztec Empire, and weaponized those conflicts, instrumentalized them for his own end, to forge this kingdom for himself, essentially, and for the crown of Spain. So I will agree with you. We do follow militarism, military expansion in a lot of other civilizations, and especially in barbarian peoples, as we've mentioned.
Can I say something?
What happened to your sound, Hapa?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
The chat claims that you were attacked by a dragon, so hopefully you.
There's a cat in the background. Maybe that's what it was.
All right.
So I wanted to comment on what you said about the Romans. Are modern day Italians the direct descendants of the people that founded Rome?
Yes.
Are they the same? You think so?
No. Southern Italians to a greater degree, but mostly yes.
Well, it depends what criteria you're using. Italians, if you go back to ancient times, a combination of three peoples, the Neolithic peoples that migrated into southern Italy and spread their agrarian or agriculture there, and that happened after 8,000 BC, so you say 7,000, 6,000 BC, you're seeing this farmers trickling from the Near East. Then you also had later on in the second BC millennium, if I got this right, that's a lot of dates when you study Western civilization, the Indo-Europeans coming in, and the Europeans exercise a very powerful cultural influence on Italy and came to dominate that area. And before the Neolithic peoples, then you had the hunters and gatherers that were living there and were in Italy. So these three peoples, you can argue, and of course there were the Etruscans too, but the Etruscans have been overestimated. Part of the reason is that after the First and the Second World War, in response to Italian fascism, academics began to elevate the Etruscans in order to sort of make Rome and Italy seem less Western, because the Etruscans were these mysterious peoples from the Near East. To this day, people are not sure who are they. Sometimes I think
it seems very unlikely that Etruscans would have been Middle Eastern, because they would have left a massive imprint on the central Italian population. See, the Etruscan kingdom covered, well, it did not stretch into the Po River Valley, that is Padania, that is the northernmost extreme of Italy, which has always had a Celtic population.
Yeah.
And during the barbarian invasions was settled in part by Lombards and Langobardians, which are German tribes. But if the Etruscans were Middle Eastern, then Italians from Emilia-Romagna and Tuscany and even parts of Latium would look far more Middle Eastern than they do. What they look like, when you look at an Italian from this area, they look like a Mediterranean Celtic hybrid. So yeah, these are white people, right?
Oh yeah, no, I think of the Italians.
And so were the Etruscans.
Just because you came from the Near East, the Neolithic farmers, it doesn't mean the Caucasian concept extends beyond Europe. They're not European, but at the same time, we need to understand that natural selection has different pressures in Italy. And so the people there become Europeanized through natural selection. In any case, my point was that during the Roman Empire, when you think of this, three peoples I just mentioned, during the Roman Empire, there is some degree, perhaps a high degree of racial mixture, because they do bring in slaves from all kinds of areas, from Carthagena, and also a lot of Celtic slaves.
They also had a Semitic admixture from the Greek colonies, I heard, later during the empire phase. So my guess is that the culture of Rome changed when the Indo-European genetics got more diluted.
It's the very idea of who is a Roman was diluted. We know that by the first century BC, St. Paul, you know, Saul of Tarsus, who was a Hebrew, was a citizen of Rome and was accorded all of the rights and privileges thereof. So who is Roman becomes no longer a question of ethnic identity or biological reality, but it's very much similar to the question of who is an American today.
This is
the unfortunate fate of empires. As they expand, they burn away the cohesion which made their expansion possible.
Exactly.
It is tragic and romantic at the same time.
I think also, if I get his name right, Tacitus wrote about this as well around the same time, and about how the Germans and the German tribes were more warlike people and more racially pure compared to his own people during that time. He described the Romans as being a more mixed race people in comparison to the Germans.
But at the same time, as I forget.
Just call me Nick. Right.
Nick, as Nick was just saying, I usually go by family name because it's a custom. But
I understand. I'm sorry, Julvius Calibrated. That's not my real last name. It's calibrated to be easy to pronounce for English speakers.
Okay.
Sorry.
But as you were saying before, the Italians were Germanized later on in the Middle Ages. I mean, you have to understand the Lombards came in. And all their Germanic.
No, yeah, from Scandinavia, and then that followed with an uptick in a warlike culture again during the Renaissance,
This is very interesting. People are always saying that people in the south of Italy and Sicily, they're admixed with Arabs and everything, but they have significantly more Norman admixture,
right?
Because this area was ruled by Norman kings for a very long time before it fell to the crown of Aragon, which accounts for all of the Spanish style architecture in Sicily, which I saw visiting there. It was very interesting. But the Normans didn't just rule Sicily, they actively settled their people from Normandy and Sicily. And to this day in Sicily and in the south of Italy, you have people with Scandinavian features, and they are the descendants of these Norman aristocratic and gentry class. I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I consider myself a trans Italian, so I have to defend their honor.
No, I was just going to say that too, that a lot of people forget this Germanization that took place later on, and they just concentrate on contacts with the Carthaginians and other people in the Near East.
So, yeah, I think that thoroughly answers Gaudius Maximus's question, not just from the personal perspective, but also from the civilizational perspective. As for my part, I will recommend that all able-bodied white men familiarize themselves with at least one weapon system which is legal for them to carry, own, and wield. A good heuristic: always carry with you the most dangerous thing you can legally carry. It will give you a good confidence, and even if you're not carrying a weapon, learn a martial art which you can apply in self-defense. It boosts your confidence greatly. We have more donations. We have a question from Gaudius Maximus again for Dr. Duchesne. The song Summer of 69 by your fellow Canadian Brian Adams is wildly popular to this day in East Asia. Are you familiar with the song, and is there something in particular about it psychologically that would make it popular in East Asia?
Well, I'm not. Could somebody say something about that song that maybe can address that question? I'm not familiar with that song. Maybe one of you is, and you have something to say about it.
Unless Kappa Perspective is knowledgeable. I only know one song by Brian Adams, and I don't like it. Hoppa, are you here?
I'm not familiar with I know the name. I know he's a singer, but I'm not familiar with the music.
Because I saw then, I cannot answer that question directly, but since we're talking about masculinity, rock and roll in music is a very masculine form of music. And we can talk about that. How do Asians relate to rock and roll?
They don't.
The whole idea of motorcycle guys driving around on their own, it's a continuation of that Indo-European spirit.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, it's very Indo-European.
Yes, the music. And somebody, The Great Order, he has written about this. He had an article in Countercurrents about rock and roll having that kind of spirit that I spoke about in my book, Uniqueness of Western Civilization. And I think it's interesting because this is some of the first things that led me to think that this is where I should go to understand the West, because all the academics and scholars that were writing about Europeans, it was always a focus on the law and the intellectuals and the bookish people. And I thought to myself, it's not the bookish, quiet people that really made the West. It's these Indo-Europeans that go back in time that nobody has connected to them. To this day, even the Indo-European scholars refuse to connect Indo-Europeans to the West. And I communicated with them. And they think, oh, you're not an Indo-European, you're not an expert, what do you know? But I think it's correct that the old people that spoke about Aryans, because initially among Germans, they did connect the Indo-Europeans to the West. They had all kinds of simplifications at that time, not much was known. But now that we know a lot about Indo-Europeans, to me, it makes even more sense to say that the foundational peoples of the West are the prehistoric Indo-Europeans who preceded Christianity and preceded the ancient Greek world.
In fact, we can claim that the ancient Greek world and European Christianity are the product of this Indo-European spirit. See, this is another thing. We talked about the Germanization of Italy, but another thing I've mentioned in my own writings and on this show and other shows is the Germanization of Christianity. Yeah. It is not, as some people will claim, a Semitic faith. It is a European faith which came from the elements of the faith came from the Judaic context, but they were reconfigured into a European thing, just as rock and roll, or at least parts of it, came from the African context of African culture in America. but it was ultimately reconfigured into this very white, very European, West, very Western thing. And I greatly recommend that people read Jared George's article on Countercurrents, Rock and Roll, and their European Soul. And of course, as my friend and former co-host of the Writer's Block Full Moon Ancestry would put it, what he loved about rock and roll and heavy metal in particular is the deep drum roll, which is like thunder rumbling. This is music to prepare for war. It is it's why the there is something about rock and roll music which makes it relaxed and it conceptually explores infinite space, to use the Spenglerian term. But in heavy metal music in particular has this deep and dark warlike rumbling. The heavy metal drum is a war drum. Whereas even in punk rock, you can see in a more vulgar context, the tss of the punk drum is what girds the body for essentially a brawl. So in a lower, more vulgar context, it still expresses a kind of, I wouldn't call it martial, but certainly violent spirit. And in the European spirit is anything if not violent. We live in a sanitized and feminized civilization, but we should acknowledge our violent and bloody past, and we should not be ashamed of it. Yes, we triumphed over everyone. We killed a lot of people, or at least our ancestors did. And if we could, we would probably do it again. If we could do it all over again, it would probably go exactly the same way. This is not something we should be ashamed of, and our music should not be ashamed of. This is just the way it is. And it's I guess this lies at the root of why I don't like Bryan Adams. He's just too soft of a, he's the kind of a musician who appeals to women, in my experience. It's someone you put on so the women do not feel threatened. You do not woo a woman with Manowar or with Rammstein, but you put on, I think the older people like putting on Barry White CDs, or what's his name? The black guy who says, "Give me all your love, baby." Is that Barry White? Doesn't matter. So yeah, Bryan Adams is very feminine music, and I guess that's the reason why the East Asians like him so much.
Is that true? I mean I don't doubt that. I wouldn't surprise me, but I never knew he was popular in Asian circles.
I didn't know that too. I'm learning it right now. But thank you for the $10 and the valuable information, Legate Maximus. If it weren't for this donation, I wouldn't know that Bryan Adams is popular in East Asia. That's an important data point. Believe it or not, this is an important data point in our exploration of the differences of the Chinese and European mind. And we have a $14 donation from Bartleby, who has donated who says a 14 for today's guest. Well, thank you that, and hopefully someone will follow it with a slightly larger number, which could form a kind of conceptual whole with the 14 figure. Who knows? I don't know. Oh, now if my mouth is running a little dry, so I'm going to throw something at Dr. Duchesne and Hapa to play with while we have been noticing, I don't know how familiar you are with the Evergrande debacle of the Chinese economy. And I was wondering, Hapa, do you have any idea about the vast difference of economic systems between white civilization, European civilization, and Chinese civilization? The Chinese will claim that they are capitalist right now, that they have a free, decentralized market economy, but I don't believe them. Do you have any opinions on that?
Well, it seems like the CCP have a lot of power over the corporations, and a lot of like pro-status people in these circles are they think that's like a good model or something. They're impressed by that. Oh, the state can control these corporations. But I don't know. To me, it's just like, I mean, the government can kind of be like a corporation, you know. It's like, it's just these sort of power structures. But I don't know. It's I don't know. I think maybe if you could phrase the question a little differently, I'm not sure what you're trying to ask here, but I don't think they could ever embrace. I don't see the Chinese at least embracing like an economically free market the way we would in the West. Their concept of capitalism would be completely different, and given their psychological nature, they're not above, you know, cutting corners and, you know, ripping off customers. I mean, they're not known for producing quality products.
That is an interesting observation. Other people have observed that whereas the European conception has always been we have an economy to serve our greater goal, that the economy, that making money is causa sui for the Chinese. They have been very accurately, in my opinion, described as the Jews of the Far East.
I think that the East Asians, I mean, they're certainly capable of it. I mean, you know, Korean products aren't that bad, and the Japanese are you know, known for producing high quality products. But I think with the Chinese, at least specifically, it's just in that case, I think it would be more of a cultural thing, maybe, you know, sub-racial, you know, ethnic. They're just not, it's not something they're known for. It's not something like they can produce quality products. They just choose not to because they're more interested in, making money, in as much money as possible by any means necessary. It seems to be their sort of mentality, even above like a good reputation. I don't know.
No, I think that should tie into, our initial discussion of masculinity, because reputation and, you know, being known as an honorable man is at the core of the Western conception of masculinity. There are a lot of these things which are just, you hear them and they instantly make sense to a Westerner. A man keeps his words. A man pays his debts. A man does, when a man says he'll do something, he does it. No ifs, ands, or buts, come hell or high water. Of course, there are exceptions, like when we call it vis maior in law. It's if it's absent in the Chinese business practice, in the Chinese economic and economic ethics, it would again reinforce our initial point that there is no masculinity as we understand it in China. If the Chinese are not prone to not keeping their word, this is the first thing that comes to my mind when I think of a man who's not really a man. Dr. Duchesne, do you have an opinion on this line of inquiry?
Well, one of the arguments that was made for the case that the Chinese were as advanced and as inclined to develop as the West was that the Chinese were always very good capitalists, that China had markets everywhere since ancient times. They engaged in a lot of commerce. Profit motivation was quite strong in China. This is an argument that Kenneth Pomeranz in particular made, and it took off. And so they even concluded that, and A.G. Frank also made this argument, and they concluded that really right through the modern era, Chinese capitalism was more vibrant, more dynamic, more international than European capitalism. And so the question then for them becomes, so why did the West industrialize and why not China? And the argument they came up with is simply that the West hit the jackpot when they discovered the Americas. The Americas had a lot of resources, cheap labor, and they extracted those raw materials and tropical goods, and that fueled the European economy, whereas the Chinese were unlucky. Of course, this argument is not very good at all. as I was mentioning before, the Chinese actually expanded considerably from the 1500s on. There are many territories on the western side, like Yunnan, and I mentioned Mongolia, and then Formosa, or was known for as Formosa, and many other lands that they took over the Chinese after the 1500s. And these were outright demographic forms of colonization from which they enriched themselves. But also there's another point, and that is that I really only came to fully appreciate the significance of Max Weber's Protestant ethic recently. I think he's correct that, yes, profit-making commercial activities have existed at all times, including beyond what Marx says, the employment of wage labor. It is true that that increases considerably only in the 1700s and after, but it was there before, and there were many big trading expeditions by civilizations through history. So capitalism, if you define it that way, has existed throughout history, but something happened that is different and happened in Europe, which is that capitalism became rationalized. Europeans realized that the point is not how much can you acquire, but how you go about acquiring it in the most efficient way possible, in a way that the entrepreneur commits himself to the enterprise as a calling, that you feel that you do want to do your best in that enterprise. You want to use the most efficient means. And, you know, I have to kind of go back and get all the details about this argument, but there is a strong psychological motivation anchor on the idea of honesty, driftiness, openness. So it's not, you cannot connive your way through your dealings. You can't superimpose yourself on others. You have to do it in a more, it is more impersonal, because it means, see, Chinese capitalism and the capitalism in many other non-Western societies was heavily influenced by kinship relationships. You do trust people, but you trust people from your own family, from your own group. You don't trust outsiders. You can cheat them and do all kinds of things to them. Whereas Europeans had weaker kinship relationships, and for them, it was not about just trust within your family, but you have a sense of trust across the board. You build your reputation that way. So I think, I don't know if I explained it that well. As I said, I would have to review this argument again, because there's so many arguments when you're dealing with the West. But I think the Protestant ethic is a powerful argument by this German Max Weber that has been, you know, they pay attention to it. But as you know, the Marxist argument took off. And the Marxist argument essentially is that capitalism is a system of exploitation, a system whereby the Europeans just took resources, enslaved Africans, and they exploited their own workers. And that's all they see. Whereas Max Weber didn't see it that way. He was concentrating on people that he knew and that he studied, and saw people that were honorable. You could count on them. They were really committed to their businesses. And in America, this spirit existed for a long time. It's now decomposing. And alien elements have penetrated into American capitalism. But you could walk into many towns and cities in America, Canada, and you would have very good dealings with capitalists and stores and so on. You could trust them.
It's an interesting thing. I think that the magic bullet was when you have a high trust society, which is based which bases compliance with the law and honesty and keeping your word as a man, which ties your honesty with your self-respect, really. This is something you are taught in the West, and I guess we have the genetic, the biological basis for it, that we should feel like lesser beings when we break our words and we act dishonestly. And our culture of honesty, and you know, I learned this from Kurt Doolittle. I've had my disagreements with him. I think his system of proprietarianism is a little crazy, but he is right that the presumption of honesty is a superpower of the Western economy and state and culture. That because when someone says something, if the default assumption is this guy is telling the truth, then every resource that would usually go into discovering whether this guy is trustworthy. I joke about there are two ways of establishing identity, and identity is, of course, the key to honesty. State identity mafia identity. A state identity is I bring up my identity card and I give it to you, and this has been issued by an authority. And even in the remote case that I do lie to you, this identity, this authority will punish me, and my identity card will be helpful in that. The second way is mafia identity. How do you know you can trust me? Well, because my friend vouches for me. This is very important to criminals. When you bring someone into a criminal enterprise, I know this because I was an attorney for 6 years, not because I'm a criminal. Although, ironically, we who are dissident rightsists who seek to protect the West, because of crackdowns and persecution, we have to start acting a little bit like the mafia. But you know a guy who knows a guy, and this guy vouches for the other guy, and he pledges his sacred honor, if there is honor among thieves, that, yeah, the guy I brought in is trustworthy, and he has skin in the game because presumably the other criminals will punish him if the other guy turns out not to be trustworthy. And that's a very good system of establishing identity and honesty, but it's also very expensive, very time-consuming, and it requires constant enforcement. It requires every person as part of the transaction to basically run his own mini-intelligence service. That takes up a lot of resources. By removing this need to constantly look for intelligence on other people, we can focus on the actual business, on actually making things or moving them closer or further as need be, on exploring, on thinking, on creating culture, on creating music, on creating art, or having shows like this. And that is the ability to trust your neighbor. And I didn't realize just how important it is and how for granted we take it as white Europeans, until it was pointed out by Nassim Taleb in Anti-Fragile that, yes, people are just too trustworthy. And when someone tells you something or asks you something, you should ask yourself, why is this person telling me this? Why is this person asking me this? And Nassim Taleb, of course, as a Levantine, he's used to operating in a low-trust environment, which the West is rapidly becoming. So we should do well to start thinking a little bit like that. Hapa, do you have any opinions now that we've blown it a little more open?
Well, I would just like to add that there's also the guilt versus shame dynamic. And in the East, in the Far East especially, shame is more is how people police each other, how society polices, you know, individuals, or rather people. They're almost not individuals, but you know what I mean. That's how people, what keeps people in line. Whereas one of the things that I really like about the West and Western people, you know, European people, is that they're able to police themselves on an individual level through guilt. They feel guilt. So that's sort of what allowed that. That's one of the main features of their character that allowed them to have high trust societies. And that facilitated a higher degree of capitalism, or like good capitalism, a good economic system, a more functional economic system. And, you know, I guess that's why they were able to, you know, create the modern world and conquer everything.
Another thing about guilt, because I know there are people in the dissident right that sometimes side with the idea of what was the other one? I forget, guilt and shame.
Oh, shame, yeah.
They side with shame because they feel that Europeans are increasingly exhibiting no shame. But people should be aware. So where does guilt come from? It means that you have, and this goes back to my point about differences in psychology. This requires, I will use the word higher inner self, a more developed consciousness, because it is really a voice within you that is speaking to you and judging you. And it's not some external force. It's not a convention. It's not someone warning you. It's your own very voice, because Protestants in particular, this was intensified because Protestantism was an important moment in Western history in that it was a full development of inner conscience. You rely on your inner conscience to make decisions as to what your religious beliefs are, your deepest beliefs. So guilt is that this inner voice is judging you and you have a dialogue with it. Protestants, even when they're not watched, they don't studies and surveys. Would you do this? And no one will ever know. They won't know that you did that. They say a higher number of them will say, no, I still will not do it. And the only reason is their inner voice is telling them, I'm going to judge you. And I'm going to, in a way, shame you. The shame is not coming from outside, but you feel ashamed that you weren't not able to control that particular inclination that you had or appetite. And so the inner voice holds you to account and checks you. And this requires a higher level of self-consciousness. And individualism is a very powerful form of individualism, because you could be alone in a room and you're tormented. People commit suicide. They cannot live with themselves, even though no one knows. They just can't live with themselves because that inner voice is just haunting them. So this is another characteristic of the psychology. I wonder if in Chinese you see these kinds of experiences.
Yes, I've seen this. I guess I don't want to go into personal stories from my own family on the Asian side. But, I don't think anyone here is trying to say that non-European races totally lack a sense of guilt. It's just more pronounced and developed in Europeans, much more so. And, with Chinese people or East Asians in general, they can feel guilt, but it's just not as pronounced. It's shame seems to be the bigger, more important thing that sort of steers their psychology, and they're not above like as you go further east, from what I understand. I've never been to the old world, but from what I've seen, like even here in America with east, eastern populations, like, maybe like Russian people from the Far East or, Chinese people, the idea of like fraud or something is more acceptable if you can get away with it, And I don't mean that in an absolute sense, I'm not saying that they think like fraud is totally acceptable, but I guess that's just part and parcel of
it. Yeah, as someone who comes from the Balkans, I can confirm there is an attitude of it's only a crime if you do it to your own people, which is very prevalent here. And in a sense, it has allowed us to resist the civilizational disease of the West for longer. But in another sense, it has not allowed us to create the civilization we have the potential to create. So, yeah, it is prevalent.
It seems like everything is a double-edged sword, There's benefits to collectivism and there's benefits to individualism, and I guess the key is balance. But there seems to be a west-east cline to it.
In this sense, I'm going to bring up Heidegger refers to this phenomenon of the consciousness, the conscious mind thinking about itself, that it has to split itself. so one part can watch the other while it is at work. And my own feelings of guilt always felt to me like there is someone on my shoulder, and we always we speak in culture too of the angel and the devil on our shoulder. So I maybe it is the greater fluidity, the cognitive fluidity of Europeans, which allows us to more readily split our consciousness and more often regard parts of our own consciousness as work. So maybe there is the whole Freudian concept of the superego. You are always watched by yourself, by part of your conscious mind, whatever you do. And this creates this feeling of guilt, that guilt is really the Heideggerian splitting of the consciousness, so one part can watch the other at work. And that part which does the watching and the moral judging is the conscious, the conscience. Well, you know, Pinocchio had to have the cricket. I guess we have, you know, the cricket all the time in our heads. I believe we have exhausted this subject. Would you agree?
Yes.
Yeah.
I gotta go soon anyway. So.
Yes. Okay. So we have one last donation from Love Hater. For the amount of $88, which completes a conceptual whole with Mr. Bartleby's earlier donation of $14. And as we only have 10 minutes left on the clock and Dr. Duchenne has to go soon, as he has just intimated, let's close off with the, well, let's call it the elephant in the room. What about the Japanese? A lot of the things we said about the Chinese and the Koreans and other East Asians, well, they just don't apply to them, or at least not all of them. Dr. Duchenne, would you care to start speculating about the Japanese question? There is a good deal of admiration for them in the dissident right. Even, well, a certain Austrian painter called them honorary Aryans. What is the deal with the Japanese?
Yes, it is something that has attracted a lot of people. The argument has been made that feudalism only existed among the Japanese when you think of it as existing outside Europe. And feudalism is based on the idea that you do have a class of aristocrats who are quite independent, a very strong sense of honor and pride in their autonomy and not being subservient. And that meant in Japan, as it did in Europe, that this feudal lord can have relationships with his own vassals and sort of be independent with his home territory. And he will come together under a shogun, a supra lord, and will do that, but not in a way in which he allows himself to be subservient to that higher lord. And there is also the sense in which there was an agreement that you will have autonomy over the territory that is granted to you. But at the same time, there is no question that the feudal relationship among the Japanese, there was a stronger element of deference, very strong deference to your superior. It wasn't as individualistic as what you have in the West. But there are other things about the Japanese. I don't really know that much. I mean, I'm sure Happy has more interesting things to say because he's Chinese, half Chinese, and he can maybe have thought about this more. The other thing I think that attracts people is that the Japanese even less, they don't complain. You don't see them in the United States ever asking for stuff, complaining about some mistreatment in the past.
They do complain about the internment camps.
Right. I was just going to say that the internment camps is one example of it, but not in the way that other people do. They're not continuously asking for something. It's more out of pride. Why did you do that to us when we were you know, hardworking Canadians just like everybody else. Anyway, these are just very general observations. I don't really know that much. I know at the same time that the Japanese were heavily influenced first by the Koreans and then the Japanese, I mean, the Chinese culture. So that influence was very strong, but they also were an island. So they were very independent and they had a very strong sense of nationality from very early on. So that's all I would say at this point.
I think that's a good take. I think that they're just kind of like a bit of an outlier in that region. They have Jomon ancestry. So the Proto-Japanese are divided into two large ethnic groups. I think somewhere around 100 years before the Common Era, you had the arrival of the Yayoi people, and they were like a Chinese sort of people from Korea. I mean, they're ethnically and culturally, they were just as good as Chinese people. And
they were farmers.
They were rice farmers, and the Jomon people were sort of like island, like hunter gatherer people. And I mean, I'm not an expert on this, you know, but this is just kind of connecting the dots from various sources. I'm sure an academic would have a lot more to say about this, but yeah, I don't think it's controversial to say that you have these two groups and they intermixed, but that you had this strain of like hunter gatherer ancestry that was very strong in the Japanese for a very long time, which I think made them culturally and racially more similar to Europeans in various different ways than they were to the Chinese, which there's speculation that the ancestors of the Jomon, the people that had more Jomon admixture rather, were predominantly the samurai class, like had more of this Jomon ancestor. So the samurai class of Japan had more hunter gatherer DNA than the rest of the population, which I think would make sense given everything else we've talked about.
The Jomon are speculated to have come to Japan from somewhere in Central Asia. Mm-hmm. So they might even have some Indo-European admixture, although obviously they do not speak an Indo-European language. Nor do they look, I mean, there is some pseudo-Caucasian phenotypes among the Japanese.
Yes.
I think, I mean, as an enjoyer and observer, longtime observer of Japanese culture, I found out that whereas the Chinese have no self, just no individual self to speak of, the Japanese do, but the ultimate honorable thing that they do, what they strive for as a nation, is the obliteration of this self. So, or putting it in the service of the collective. So what we're probably observing there is a people who are not entirely East Asian, having built a culture as a superstructure overarching their biology to make them more compliant to the East Asian mode of being, which was obviously necessary because that's the part of the world where they live, even though the ecology of Japan is rather different from the rest of East Asia. That's my speculations from having really observed Japanese culture for all these 20 years now, I guess.
Yeah, that sounds about right. You know, that could also be the influence of Buddhism as well. They seem to have their own take on it. There's Zen Buddhism, which is, you know, just these like koans, but it's kind of fun. They really are different. It's really, you know, I'm not, for someone that's half Asian, I really, like a lot of Asian Americans, I'm not directly like well acquainted with East Asian culture that well. Just racially East Asian people here in the West, and you know, but yeah, well,
that is an important cohort, anyways.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We are unfortunately running out of time, so let me just acknowledge all of the last minute donations which have come in. We have a donation from Thin Red Line. amounting to a diamond on DLive. That it, and he says many of the problems of corruption and fraud, and he continues, in the next diamond donation on the Balkans stem from the Turkish occupation. That deserves a stream of its own, Thin Red Line. So if you would just bring that up next time, or sometimes when we are discussing Balkan cultural and economic issues, I will give you the full, probably half hour answer. I'm sorry, I cannot answer that right now. Gadius Maximus donates a diamond, says, I can't believe they didn't know summer of 69. Well, we are, you know, academic types here, Gadius. You should know that by now. And the Thin Red Line has donated one less diamond. Were the Aino originally a white people? Difficult to say. They might have had some Indo-European admixture. I think that is my opinion. And we have lemons coming in, an ice cream and four lemons. Again, very significant number, it seems to be, this 14 from Norse Nature, for which we are, of course, grateful. Unless you have anything else to add, Dr. Duchesne and Hapa, I think we can sign out.
No, it was great discussion talking to you two guys. And, you know, it was good.
Yeah, great discussion.
I think, you, of course, if the admins and mods, you guys are heroes. You're just dominating the chat as always. They would just post the relevant links for Dr. Duchesne and Hapa Perspective in the chat. You should all regularly follow the Council for European Canadians, Dr. Duchesne's website, and I think all everything that he has written, all of his thoughts are collated there. And you should also follow him on Gab. I hear he is just fascinating to follow on Gab. I should probably do so myself. And of course, Hapa Perspective, he has a blog. If you would just post that link in the chat, thank you, mods. He is also very active on Telegram. I always start my day with the Hapa posts. They are very interesting.
Thank you.
And yeah, he I think he called me a glacier glider.
Oh, I don't know what that that's means, the new slang. That's like you know, snow. That's you know, there's snow and then there's glacier glider. And it came from a YouTuber that was talking about demographics. Ah, it was like sun people, glacier gliders, and you know.
Well, now you learn something new every day. You learn a new politically incorrect term every day. That is wonderful. And that is, and of course, you can follow me on Telegram. I have a Telegram channel now where these announcements make. Of course, everything with regard, at this point, everything I do goes up on countercurrents.com. You can check out my my archive link over there, which I'm sure the mods will put in the chat. Thank you, mods. And this show will be up there soon. Now, for a brief promotional period, the writer's blocks will not be behind the paywall. It will be accessible for free on the Countercurrents website. But that period is going to eventually end. So I encourage all of you to subscribe to the Countercurrents paywall. That's $120, I think $140 annually. It could be $120. I should double check before advertising it. Or $1,400 for a lifetime subscription, which I am told is more cost effective. And of course, this gives you access to the Countercurrents articles immediately, and you get to comment without moderation. Now, obviously, whoever abuses this privilege will lose it, so use it wisely. That is, I believe, everything we have to say. I want to thank Dr. Duchesne and Hapa Perspective for appearing on this show. I want to thank our moderators, Bartleby and Gadius Maximus, for keeping the chat civil and for fulfilling all of my various and, you know, dubiously reasonable requests today. And I want to thank everyone who donated. And we have greatest donations, the highest number of lemons donated on DLive from the Thin Red Line in first place with 300, Gadius Maximus in second place with 200, and Old Man Yinzer in third place with 100. Don't you just love it when it's just neat and nice that way? Well, this has been the Writer's Block on Sunday, September the 20th, year of our Lord 2021. And so we will see you next time. Tune in and bye-bye.